Hello, everybody, and welcome to the UFC Pick Show with me, Dan Hardy, and I'm joined again by Ollie Richardson. We're going to be reviewing UFC 257 and all of your amazing picks.
Wow.
And we tried to fix the mic situation because I bought these arms and I expected them to be able to clamp onto the table, but for whatever reason, like, they just take up so much space. I don't know. I'm working on it. We'll get there with the...
Didn't expect me to communicate in Morse code during the last podcast. So apologies to everyone who got a little bit of a shock in their headphones during the last podcast. I will endeavour to calm down a little bit and keep my hands to myself.
Yeah, we do listen to your feedback, so we do appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. 55,000 people on the last one. Appreciate it. Right. First episode, yeah. Very cool. Got my Fight Island sunglasses on because I'm going to have to retire these very soon. So I just thought I'd get them out for one more event. Obviously, with the last Fight Island event having just happened, UFC 257 was very, very cool.
Wow, what an event!
What we'll do is we'll quickly move the card because obviously we want to talk about the main event and co-main event, but. Just quickly, so obviously we had a few predictions. Did you which predictions did you get right?
Any so this didn't go really well. I'm not going to lie. I have had better days in terms of predictions. Not only did I get
you predicted I was going to win a lot of my fights for a start.
Heavily invested in you winning some of them. it didn't go very well, did it? Not only did I think I picked one correct, but also one of my picks decided to try and smuggle contraband into the Fight Island bubble. So,
yeah, what was it? What was in the bag? Do you know?
Who knows? Was it? It's got to be a Mackie D's. Please get me something.
I don't know what it was because I heard he passed his wristband through the
taped it on. Something like about jumping balconies.
I don't know. It sounded great.
Sounds like a Tom Cruise movie.
Sounds like
to
the
me.
Old Cage Rage days. I won't tell those stories right now, but there was some.
Can you imagine the minute that Dana found that out?
Yeah,
after everything that organization has done to get this bubble going, and then someone does that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, his reaction was not surprising. Disappointing because he's an undefeated prospect and he's probably got a bright future. But
disappointing because that was a guaranteed pick for me, and I needed them.
That's the most important thing. It affected your picks.
I mean, Brad Tavares is my favourite fighter at the minute because he's the only one I picked right.
Mate, he looked good as well. He did look good. I actually thought that might go the opposite way. I thought Antonio Carlos Jr. might just be able to drown him with pressure.
Yeah, he's a big lump too, chew face, isn't he? Yeah.
But Brad looked good. You know, his striking's improving constantly. Sarukian's very, very impressive as well, isn't he? Just cruisers.
Really liked him. Liked him a lot.
I mean, there were a couple of those. Like, Sarukian was one, and then we discussed Lentz against Ivlev as well.
Yeah, it's kind of, a bit of taste in our mouths, right? I think Nick Lentz has retired off the back of that. I think he's damaged his eye again. I think we touched on the first one, or maybe privately, that he's been out for a while with some vision problems. And it's just kind of sad, isn't it? You know, yeah, it's a gladiatorial sport, and you know, people get hurt, but you never want to sort of hear about that. And as for Evloev,
I called his debut. I'm sure it was his debut, and like he was coming over. What was he, M1 champ?
Yeah, didn't seem to get out of third gear, really, did he?
Not at all.
Nice and tight, nice and flowing, great striking.
The one thing he's missing is a finish in the UFC. Mm. But he's not got loads of... He's not stopping everybody outside of the UFC. What's he got? 1, 2, 3, 4 rear naked chokes, which comes from people just breaking under his wrestling pressure. He's got a TKO from punches and a KO from... two KOs, one from kicks and one from punches.
I mean, it's a good point. The dominance that he had over Lentz, should he actually be looking to finish that? You know, should have that been a finish? He was clearly dominant for a lot of that fight.
Yeah, I mean, you can keep winning and you can stay in the UFC and stay undefeated and keep winning by decision. It does get to a point where opportunities pass you by, though, when you don't have those highlight reel finishes. You know, like one big highlight reel knockout or two close back-to-back fights with that marketing machine behind you can get you a long way.
Yeah, it's not just about the result, is it?
No, it's not. But then he's 14-0. I mean, you know, like that's really early. If you compare that to boxing, this guy's still fighting journeymen that are like 84-86.
You know, he's still picking and choosing who he's fighting at that stage
in
boxing.
And look who he's fighting. Like Lentz, Grundy, Enrique Barzola's tough. Right. Like, he's a tough, gritty individual. And then Sung Woo Choi as well, another very tricky tough individual, and that was a featherweight fight.
Man, I'm sure we'll see him again pretty soon, right? He didn't seem to take any damage at all, really. He'd be good to go.
None at all, and his English is improving.
Hmm.
I did appreciate that. No, I was impressed with him, and you know, it's sad to see Lentz go out that way, especially because the fighter interviews that we did, because obviously he was supposed to be on an earlier card. When we spoke to him, he really talked like the sport had kind of had it in for him. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
He got tough breaks.
And yeah.
He never had the push that he should have had because he wasn't maybe as marketable as some of the other guys. And
I mean, I get it, and I think to a degree,
his record, dude. Look at the guys he's fought.
To a degree, you'll agree though, is you get from the UFC what you put into the UFC. You know, it's exactly. not, you know, it's not a charity. Mm-mm. They'll get behind you if you give them something to get mm-hmm. behind. But that, you know, if you don't market yourself, they're not really going to do it for you. They'll do the basic level for you, but if you really want to, you know, kick it into overdrive, you got to earn that. They don't really give anyone anything in the UFC, do they?
No,
that's not their remit.
Like I always say this. Like if I'm talking to a fighter that's young in their career, I always say to them, like the key's in the word promotion. Like that's what they are. The UFC is a promotion machine. Like if you are easy to market, easy to sell, then you're going to get that machine behind you, and it's going to do you, you know, it's going to do you really well. But you have to. That's your responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't. I mean, you can get so far winning by decision over and over again, but that's when you have to put an 8-fight win streak together before you get a title shot.
Yeah, like the mindset almost should be. It is. You are your own business within this business.
For
like,
sure.
You are a product.
Yeah.
You know, give them a reason to do the advertising.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You
know,
and then they'll blow you up. Yeah. They can't wait to blow someone up.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they do. That's how they dominate. But you got to give them a reason. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Yeah. You've almost got to view it as like a collaboration.
Yeah.
Like, you've
right.
still
yeah.
got to do your part, and your part is not just inside the octagon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's everything else.
Inside the octagon.
And you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of fighters say the thing that happens inside the octagon is almost the relief of it. It's everything yeah. else that goes on around it that, you know, drains them of energy and is a big commitment for them.
That's it.
But that's, you know, that's where the money's at.
Part
you better
of it,
get it done.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's part of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was a great fight. So you went round three and Prakniar won.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty close, right?
It was
I feel
close.
Like... Roundtree could have, on a different day, Roundtree could have took that.
Yeah.
But then it's hard to make that
awful,
claim.
Though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So kind of long and like shit.
I mean, it was a good fight, right? I enjoyed watching that fight. You know, there was some technical component to it. It's tough to make Roundtree's case when he was dropping off so much towards the end of the fight, because in reality, if that's a fight, there's only one guy, you know, if you extend that round another 5 minutes, we know where that's going, right?
Yeah.
That's not going Roundtree's favour. So it's difficult to make that claim. Within that context, but yeah, it was close and big lumps whacking each other hard, weren't they?
yeah but it's just like it's the simmering underbelly of the light heavyweight division. There's so many guys above them that like they're gonna have to cover some serious ground. I mean, what's Prakniar now, is that one in his last four?
Yeah.
And
he might be relieved though, wouldn't he?
Oh,
be relieved,
sure.
Just to get that one in there.
It's not a good look.
So, I mean, we could probably put a question mark over that pick, really, couldn't we?
Not
that
really.
Result.
I mean, you know, your picks are your picks. You know. This is why I stay out of these things. I play devil's advocate. This next fight was a lot of fun. Sarah McMahon's a hell of a wrestler, but Juliana Peña, when we were sitting watching this, like Veronica and I, we saw exactly the same thing. Like Sarah McMahon's a competitor, and she's a great competitor.
I thought she was doing great.
Really, really good. But Peña's a fighter. And there is a point of difference, right?
There's a point where the
competition becomes a fight, and some people just check out in those moments. Like I always used, like, and this is no criticism on him because obviously he's doing really well at the moment. But Ryan Bader was very much in that situation in the UFC. Like he was great when it was competing with someone.
Yeah, he's an athlete, right?
As soon as it became a fight, that's when it's like I kind of. Like there's an edge that you need, and I mean what we've seen in Peña is that she does have that edge.
I don't know if you're the same, but the longer we're sort of around and in existence, the more I start believing in archetypes more and more and more. And there is that athlete archetype, there is that martial artist archetype, and you know, and there is that fighter archetype.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a blend of the three. I know we've talked about it previously. There's a blend of the three, but you can sort of see where people sit in there. Man, I thought Sarah was killing it. I thought she was doing really good. But I tell you what, I probably didn't give Pena the respect that she deserves, because if you're going to fight someone with that wrestling, what do you do? Well, pretty much that.
Yeah.
She was never still. She was constantly attacking from her back. She was hitting her with elbows and making it genuinely uncomfortable for her. She was throwing up submissions all the time. Like, what do you want as a wrestler? Well, just lie there and let me, you know, dominate from the top position. Mm-hmm. Not a chance, was there?
No.
She was great.
Scrappy.
Yeah.
Scrappy.
Yeah.
And I know she called out, Amanda Nunes as well. But there are a couple more fights that she needs to have in this division. At least one.
Yeah, Amanda didn't seem like she was having it on social media, was she?
No, I mean, it makes sense, though. I mean, she in her previous fight, she was choked out by Jermaine Durandamy, who's also lost to Amanda Nunes. I don't think I've seen enough of Pena for her to... I mean, she's 10-4 in her career.
Yeah.
You know, like she's...
A couple more. String a couple more wins on top of that win, and, you know, she's in a good position to make that call, isn't she?
I mean, you know, you look at her last... Like, if you look at when she came back after becoming a mother, her last fight was 2017, the beginning of 2017 against Shevchenko. Then she came back midway through 2019 and beat Nico Montaño, who won the Ultimate Fighter, so technically a former champ, or that's a weird one. Then she lost to Durandamy, and then she's just beat Sarah McMahon. Like, she needs a Holly Holm on that record for me. She needs a... Even a Raquel Pennington would be a good name for her to have, because she's still... I mean, I know the rankings have not been done until tomorrow, but she's seventh currently, and she'll jump up a couple of spaces. But not much from a win like that, because Sarah McMahon was already below her anyway, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good solid win to get her going again, trying to get on a streak again, and then get that streak done and call out the champ. And,
not quite a title shot ready, though.
Not quite.
I think, I mean, that'd be good. If I'm thinking, like, Pennington and then home.
Yeah.
Two great wins. You can't deny it.
Get people buying into those fights as well, yeah, from a promotion point of view.
Definitely. I mean, you know, beating Durandamy and then Sarah McMahon would have been a different thing, but with that loss, I think that just does slow her down a bit.
Yeah. She was great. But like you say, she probably needs a couple more, and then she's in that position.
So what else? What was the next one? So with Brad Tavares, we talked about.
Yeah.
Great. Look fantastic.
Yeah.
Armin Sarukian's a monster.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I wonder where he'll go next, what they'll do with him.
He's another guy, though. He's decisions, isn't he? Like, he needs a finish. Like,
I mean, he's got the power for a finish, right?
For sure.
Easily.
But three, he lost his debut to Islam Makhachev. That still sounds crazy. He makes the debut against
Makhachev. Yeah, cheers. Cheers, guys. Yeah. Thanks for that debut.
So... he's had four decisions in the UFC, but he's got some stoppages outside. A lot of rear naked chokes and guillotines, anaconda, knockouts, technical knockouts. There's definitely a lot of potential in him.
I think he could.
He's simmering, isn't he?
They don't have to look after him, but if they're strategic with the next few fights, and he could be really, really good.
He's had tough fights, though. I mean, you go like Makhachev, Aubin Mercier, Davy Hamosh, and then Matt Favola. They're all tough fights.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not surprising he's going to decisions with them, because they're all tough individuals. But there's definitely, like you look at this division, you start thinking to yourself, you have to do something spectacular at lightweight to get your head above water.
Awful division to be part of.
But there's some good guys at the bottom end of that division that he could fight. I mean, like... obviously, Ali Aquinta would be a hell of a fight for him. He's at number 10. But Dariush, Gregor Gillespie, Drew Dober, there's people that around.
I mean, you can't help but make good fights in that division at the minute.
And he's formidable everywhere by the looks of it. I like him.
I think it's going to be interesting to
watch him develop. What is he, about 18? 24.
Hey.
All the time in the world. Right, main card.
There we go.
Well, before we get into this.
Yeah, I enter into this one with a little bit of trepidation.
Is that two wins on Rodriguez's record?
What should we talk about in this fight? Anything stand out to you at all? I'll take it. I'll take it for now.
I'm going to check the camera's still rolling.
Right. Apparently. I mean, it was a good fight, and great win for Rodriguez. I felt a little bit for... Hibas, because I thought she needed, you know, this could have got her going again. This could have put her right in the frame for some bigger fights. But Rodriguez was great. I'm sure you'll have an opinion on this, but I thought Hibas's ring craft was really poor. She just sort of followed her around and just didn't cut her off at all, really. And then, you know, the consequences of that were evident. I still really like her. I think she's a solid fighter. I think she's going to be great. I wonder what they do with her next, as in she seems like she'd be pretty marketable to the company. So whether they, you know, manipulate who they're gonna put her against next to try and get her a win, keep her in the company, might be something they look at. And yeah, Rodriguez, she bangs hard, right?
Yeah,
really hard.
She's a longer range fighter. She's a good striker. She had a better understanding of how to use the space as well, because as you said, Amanda was kind of following her around a little bit, just pressuring her. And, you know, pressure is excellent. Obviously, it's important in a fight if that's the way that you want to apply your game plan. But you've got to apply it correctly. Otherwise, you end up following and walking into traps. And when you're fighting someone that's so much taller, like it was a lovely back step that she walked her onto those punches. Like, she knew she was slightly out of range for whatever Hibas was throwing. But yeah, and obviously, you know, obviously, there's no doubt it could have been stopped when Rodriguez thought the fight was over.
It wasn't really going to go any other way, right? It seemed like that was the appropriate time to step in and stop that.
There's a decisiveness that you need from the referees, which is where, you know, and I spoke about it in the breakdown I did in my counter to Herb. Like, in the Robbie Lawler Ben Askren fight, part of the reason why Robbie Lawler came back to consciousness was because Askren released because he thought Herb was stepping in. Now, part of the problem is the indecisiveness of making the fighter, giving the fighter the impression, because none of us want to beat the opponent up after the fight referee stopped it.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to be looked at as a dirty fighter. So you don't want to, like, be still punching the person as the referee's dragging you off. Like, you want it to be a nice clean break. And, you know, these two girls were competitors. Like, that was obvious going into the fight. They weren't there to, you know, to hate on each other. So it was just like, when you give a fighter that opportunity for the fight to be over, I mean, her natural reaction, she read his body language. That was an instinct thing.
Yeah. And I know people were saying that he didn't touch anyone, but everything else was suggesting that way.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, this is elite level pro sport, and everybody that is involved has to be decisive. That's
for sure.
This is not a couple of grades down. This is the pinnacle of it, and the people that are involved in the pinnacle of it have to be elite in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's the point.
Yeah, but I'll circle this back around just as a counter, because, like, you remember when Durandamy fought Holly Holm for the featherweight title. And, like, there were twice she was criticised for punching after the bell. But, like, two things. I always say this. First of all, we don't have a hearing test before a fight.
Right.
So, like, you can't assume that we hear the bell. The other thing as well, and I'm sure you'll know the wording better than I, but the kind of the sensory shutdown of certain...
Well, everything narrows, right?
Yeah.
Vision narrows, hearing narrows, you know, and it's an evolutionary instinct is concentrate on the major threats, not listening to, you know, what's happening five rows up in the crowd, because that's taking my attention away from someone that's trying to effectively kill me, you know? So,
exactly.
Of course, I mean...
So you're not listening for the bell. And the bell is not for the fighters. The bell is for the referee, the horn, should I say, in MMA. So, like, it is important for these referees to get involved and to make sure they're between the fighters. It's not the fighters' responsibility to decide when the fight's over, because that's when confusion arises. And it's also not the fighters' responsibility if they're not stopped when the fight should be stopped, because that is the referee's responsibility to get in the way. I mean, I remember Mark Goddard stopping one of my fights, and I was already mid-punch when he dived in the way, and I
just
punched him
it.
Right in the thigh. He grabbed me afterwards. He was like, "You punched me in the play." you know, but it's that.
You know, I was going to say I'd rather that referees stop things early than late, which, you know, there's some truth to it, but I would also rather than just stop it when they're supposed to stop it. You know, yeah. Again, it just circles yeah. back to you need to be right.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you're paid and trained for is to be right. And of course, you know, we all make mistakes. And I think that's fair enough, but we have to be careful of the patterns of mistakes that are constantly happening. Yeah. The same things happening, you know. No one's infallible, but you know, patterns are patterns, and
yeah,
you don't play this sport.
No,
you just don't play it.
You don't play fighting, do you?
Yeah,
no, yeah, certainly not. So okay, let's on to the next one.
Jessica Ryan JoJo.
No, we got Mahmoud, didn't we? Mahmoud Muradov against Andrew Sanchez, flying knee and TKO.
Oh my God, I've missed this fight.
Did you miss it?
I've not seen it. Oh, how have I missed that?
You must have meditated through it.
I probably fell asleep, to be honest.
It was the thing is, poor old Andrew Sanchez.
That's because I didn't make a pick on it. That's why that wasn't up there for picks.
No, that's true. It wasn't. No, it wasn't.
I've completely missed that.
Yeah. I always feel a bit bad for Andrew Sanchez because he's one of those guys that he's not particularly marketable.
Right.
So he gets the tough fights. He's a bit in a bit of a Nick Lentz kind of situation. Right. And
Muradov, we can't market you, so you're just going to have to do the tough route all the way
exactly.
through.
Exactly. It's uphill in the dark, ooh, in the snow, you know, with twice as many newspapers as you should be carrying. He's got one of those kind of careers. Like, you look at the guys he's fought, you know, he's like lost to Anthony Smith. So, like, he won the Ultimate Fighter at light heavyweight. And you know, the hope was that he was going to be a really strong wrestler in this division. But it seems to get to that point, similar with Sarah McMahon, is like it goes from being a competition to a fight. And I will say that he did regroup pretty well in the third round. Like he did make an effort in the third round to pressure him, even though his leg was beat up and Muradov was just a bit too quick and athletic for him. But yeah, you know, I mean, it was a good fight for Muradov. He's definitely on the rise. It's someone to watch out for.
You know what? If that was in the picks thing, I probably would have picked that. You know?
Definitely would have picked
that. I'm almost sure I would have picked that one.
I tell you what, his views were good on the channel, weren't they? A lot of people wanted
to know, right? A little niche.
But like, you look at his, like I like a record like this guy's got. Let's have a look at his record. 1-0, 2-0, 2-1, 3-1, 3-2, 4-2, 4-3, 4-4. There was a point in his career where he was 4-4. Frustrating. He's been stopped. He's been choked out.
Shows good resilience, right? Like deep resilience to be able to turn that around.
Exactly. And then he went on a 3-fight win streak. Then he lost another one. Then he went on a 4-fight win streak. Then he lost another one. And now he's on, what's that? A 14-fight? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14-fight win streak now.
Found his flow.
That's beautiful.
He's found his flow. Like, watch out.
You'd definitely picked him.
Right, yeah, I'm almost sure,
I'd definitely advise you to pick him anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, go on then. Jessica Rye Calderwood.
Wow, JoJo is amazing, right? Yeah. She looked in great shape for a start. She looked in really good shape. She looked really sharp. I thought Jessica sort of stood in the range of all the places you were going to stand. That was not the range to pitch your tent in. Do you know what I mean? She just stood right on the end of every single kick that JoJo threw, it seemed.
Yeah.
I thought their energy expenditure strategy was horrendous. The bell went and they just went, ooh, let's go. And they went straight after it. But yeah, JoJo was great. Really savage in the clinch, like really did quite a bit of damage in the clinch, right? I just thought it was genuinely a really, really good win against, you know, a tough girl.
Yeah, a veteran.
Yeah,
I mean, been around. Like, she really is a veteran.
Yeah,
Jessica, I was at 25 fights, 15-9. Yeah, she's tough and she's durable and she's a good test for everybody. And we needed to see JoJo against someone that was going to close her down, pressure her against the fence. And I mean, she stood on the outside enough for JoJo to look really good at times. Mm. But also when she closed the distance, JoJo had elevated her game to a point where she was able to be effective in the clinch and stuff a lot of the takedowns. I mean, what were the...
Yeah, I mean, whatever JoJo's doing, I would recommend she keeps doing it because she looked like she'd evolved to me. She looked like she'd evolved a little bit and she took that game up a level.
You just find your rhythm at some point. And obviously, you know, she's in Vegas with John Wood.
Yeah, he's clearly you know, having a significant impact, right?
Yeah, you know, an experienced coach. He's been in there with, you know, he's cornered a lot of fighters at a lot of different levels. You know, he's in the gym every day. You get to recognize patterns there. Let's have a quick look at this. Yeah, so she only got one takedown scored against her. That's an improvement. I still think she's in a similar situation to Pena. We still need to see her have one more
good solid one.
One more good solid win.
Get that platform. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then boost up off that. I'm happy, you know, I was happy for her. It's hard to not be happy for her, right? She just seems so nice. And, you know, you could see that it seemed like there was a bit of pressure on her to get that right. And she got it right. She really, really got it right.
Yeah. And there's some interesting fights up above her. I mean, I'll get into it in the aftermath of my talk. I'm going to answer some questions. I know we've got some questions on Calderwood and where she goes next.
Mm.
But she definitely needs another fight or two before she can start thinking about Shevchenko. I just don't think she's... The holes in her game that we've seen, although we've seen improvements against Jessica Eye, we need to see her against someone that's really going to...
Yeah.
Like, pressure her, drag her to the floor, you know.
I know, it always seems like I come back to the same thing, but the way Shevchenko moves is that echelon above, right?
It is.
And you always see it, those top guys, they just move a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Or that intermuscular coordination, they're just moving in perfect synchronicity and timing.
I mean, that's why Andrade's an interesting problem for Shevchenko, because she's like hyper explosive, very powerful and quite unpredictable.
Yeah.
And if you've got someone that's very efficient and very clinical in the way that they go about stuff, it's so difficult to find your way in on that competition level. You've got to almost do something that's so different to what, like, for example, if you're Joanna, like, you know full well, if you're stepping in there with her and you want to go technique for technique striking,
that's like, going to be rough.
It's going to be a long night, even if you're the best in the world, as we saw with Zhang Weili. Whereas if you rose Namajunas and you just bite down, you close distance and you crack her harder than she's ever been punched in the first round.
This is a weird segue into the next fight, but, you know, like tempo camouflage can be a really useful...
that is a good segue.
Strategic. Like move, right, is you can just bluff they think you're going to be at a certain tempo, but you're actually, you know, you're just lulling them into this tempo, and then suddenly, you know, you resonate in that tempo and then you change up that tempo. I've caught you in the trap, right? And this is where the segue bit comes in. I thought that's what he was doing. I thought that's what Dan Hooker was doing. I thought, he looks really slow here and methodical, and I thought he was playing a really smart game. This is how great I am at picks. I thought he was playing a really smart game, because Chandler was hyped up and he was angry and he was coming in, he was moving fast, he was in and out and he was testing stuff, and I thought, oh, okay, that's smart. He's just playing nice and loose, he's not expending any energy, he's sort of lulling him in, and I thought he was, you know, maybe he was setting a trap. Turns out that was another pick that was completely wrong. But I mean, that is a strategy that can be put into place. It didn't work out very well this time. And then on reflection, I don't know if Hooker was sick or overawed by something, but he just didn't look like he was bouncing at the speed he needed to be at.
I just don't honestly think he had time.
I've watched the fight rushed.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched the fight back a few times today, and my first thought is that he normally looks pretty good in the first couple of minutes. He looks technically, looks sharp, and he makes good decisions. I think they may have had the similar thought process to what we discussed about not being out in the open to be shot on, because Chandler will just drive straight through you. So circling against the fence gives him a better opportunity of stuffing those takedowns. But at the same time as doing that, I think he was being forced into a particular direction by Chandler. Because if you watch the way that Chandler does it, he level changes and he keeps throwing that long right to the body. Yeah. And if you watch the way that Hooker's moving, like if Chandler's moving at boxing range, he keeps his hand fairly high as he's circling. So he's not circling onto the left hook. But every time he saw Chandler level change with the right hand to the body, he also was expecting him to shoot him into the fence. So he was bringing
ready to scoop
hands down.
Right.
So then as Chandler level changed, you watch him, he throws the right hand out. I'm going to break it down on aftermath. As he throws the right hand out, the right foot follows, and then he follows with a massive left hook.
Sickening left hook.
Beautiful. But I mean, intended, fully intended to catch him right on the end of his movement. and intended to catch him when his hands were down expecting a takedown or a body shot.
What an entry into the UFC.
And his call out was awesome as well. He did the whole Ric Flair thing, didn't he?
Yeah, you say awesome, I say like cringeworthy. I can't stand that rhetoric.
No.
But I did see an interview with him after and he was sort of like, nah, I didn't sort of mean it the way like that. I just know I need to hype up and call people out and, you know, Dana told me to make sure that I make a big fuss about it. But I personally can't stand that WWE call out type thing.
Go down the Colby Covington route.
No, like that. Like I can't watch Colby. I can watch
Did
him as a fight,
but
can't.
Goddard?
No. Probably
said,
warranted.
He said the reason that Goddard stopped the fight when he was fighting Usman. The reason that Goddard stopped the fight is because he's against Brexit.
Oh man, come on now. Like tenuous link.
He's been wearing that Make America Godless hat for how many years?
Anyway,
it's all backfired.
The political side that he took in America seems to have really worked out for him. He doesn't look like an idiot at all now.
No. He's got the Buffalo dude
on his
side.
He's going to be cornering
the
him
woman,
soon.
Did you see the one with the hat on that says spread love and she was telling a police officer to F off? That's brilliant.
Oh, man.
Brilliant.
Just relax, America. You just need to relax for a little bit. Anyway, brighter times ahead by the sounds of it.
Yeah, right. So co-main event then. Chandler, great intro to the UFC. Dan Hooker in a bit of a bad spot, has kind of reached his ceiling currently at lightweight. Probably needs to regroup a bit. I mean, he's taken a few big shots as well. I won't mind seeing him take 12 months out and just work on his game because he's got the range and he's got the coaches and the people around him to be on Izzy's level of striking.
Yeah.
I
would personally, because I err on the side of probably fight health over most things, in that when someone gets knocked out in that manner and like, you know, that seems significant, is they should be encouraged to take extended periods of time off, let that brain trauma sort itself out, let it heal. Like neurology in general heals 9 times slower than muscle, so you need an extended period of time to settle that down. And I don't know how it would happen because I don't think it's in place with the UFC, but I feel like they should be encouraging that.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, I don't know how you facilitate that financially, but I feel like they should be pushing pretty hard that there should be a mandatory.
Yeah.
Or a stricter adhered to mandatory, because I know there is a mandatory, but somehow, some way they should be for sure encouraging it.
Yeah. Honestly, the biggest problem I see most of the time is fighters just don't understand that they have to take it seriously.
Mm.
I remember when I got knocked out against Condit at 120, I was back in the gym Monday morning working with Andre because he had a fight coming up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I remember Joe Silva calling me. That's old school for you. I remember Joe Silva calling me because...
It's a conspiracy. Oh, no. Something else.
Because he'd seen on some social media that I was back in the gym working.
Yeah.
And he called me up. He's like, "What are you doing? Like, you've got to not, yeah. No contact." And it wasn't until I'd actually had that conversation that I'm like, "Oh, okay, maybe I should." I mean, I was fortunate. Like, I can think of like one time in the gym, I was knocked out, and then I remember a Thai boxing match where I was dropped a couple of times, and then the Condit fight.
Yeah.
But then there were big gaps in between. And we were never sparring. I mean, we had hard sparring sessions, but not because we were brutalizing each other, just because we were working.
Mm.
Like, we were grafting and grinding. The pace was hard. No one was ringing each other's bell every week, though. Not on the fans.
I've just seen it too many times in the rugby codes. Like, you know, people sort of forgetting large periods of time. And, you know, a good friend of mine, Ben Herring, retired because he just couldn't shift his headache. You know, it was like, imagine having a headache for a year. Like, that's, you know,
yeah,
it's not, it's
exactly what we're doing.
It's really serious. I know a lot around CTE is coming out from the NFL, and they're obviously making inroads into that. And I know the UFC is doing what it can do, and it's a bit of a slow process. And I get that because it's, you know, it's relatively new. And unfortunately, it falls back on the fighter and the management of their ego that, oh no, I should get back and start working, you know. It's a tricky place. But, you know, we've got to be careful because there's certain consequences to that repeat head trauma you're not going to see now. And then when it happens, when the consequences happen, it's irreversible. Nothing's, you know, the waterfall's falling now. And, you know, it's not a pretty place to be. A couple of people I know with sort of mid-stage to end-stage Parkinson's, not from combat sports, but, you know, that's not some... some alpha male type dudes that have got it, and it's you know, it's rough. Pretty upsetting to see.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's not like I love, you know me, I love a good knockout as much as the next guy, probably a bit more than the next guy. And I've delivered a few myself as well, and I've taken two. Like, it's a part of the sport. We get it. Like, if you're a mountain climber, you might die a mountain climber. Yeah. If you're a deep sea diver, you might have a.
It's an accepted consequence.
Of course, it's not
for a fighter. It's an accepted consequence. Of course. And
is it that says it's not a tickling contest? Is it Teddy Atlas? Like, we know. Yeah. We know the risk. We just need to.
It's not that though. Like it's two grown adults.
Yeah.
Saying to each other, I know what's, you know, I know the consequences. It's not that bit. I'm comfortable with that bit. It's how we look after them after that happens, because you take that consequence away, and you know, it's not the highest level of combat sport that's ever existed.
For sure.
Yeah. So
you saw the video that of Dana during the Holloway Cater fight,
right?
I mean, that's going to be doing its rounds. Everyone's going to see that soon. But of him talking to one of the other UFC executives and being like, you know, this is not good. Like, we need to make sure he's taken to a hospital straight away.
Yeah, yeah. And the days after and the weeks after and the checkups and like, it, obviously it's fine for Max because he's done really well for himself. But if you're entry-level fighter on entry-level salaries, or not even salaries, but entry-level pay packets, you know, are you going to be able to support yourself enough to get the medical stuff you need 3 months later, 6 months later? Yeah. So going back to, you know, the professional rugby codes, if you are taken off the pitch for concussion, that's 3 weeks mandatory lay down. You're not no contact. There's a graded contact protocol to get you back in there.
Like cognitive checks and stuff.
So SCAT test. And I know the, you know, the PI is working along that. The PI in Shanghai, you know, talking to Dean Amasing over there, they're doing a lot of work around that, and they'll get better. You know, they will get better. Mm. And, you know, part of the PI being set up is to put this bubble around the, I shouldn't use that word. That word is overused massively at the minute. You know, putting this blanket around fighters to help them just be the best they can be. And, you know, health is obviously a massive part of that.
Dude, I tell you what I was watching yesterday, which is fascinating. And I've in a very short period of time become a big fan of Lex Fridman.
Yeah, right, you've mentioned,
and
yeah.
He did an interview with Dan Gable, which was an older interview that he actually brought back and posted upon his channel because, you know, a lot of people missed it first time around. And one of the most fascinating things about it is Dan Gable's talking about what he would have done differently. And he said there was a point where we weren't allowed to drink water because it was considered to toughen us up. He said, and I can think of so many wrestling practices where I was so dehydrated and fatigued that at the end we weren't even really wrestling. We were just propping each other
up. Trying not to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he said, so one of the main things I would change is that, like, I would go back and I would hydrate myself so I was in a place where I could learn.
You know, like, amazing that you're having that conversation. Amazing. How are you having that conversation? Like, but I've seen it, again, going back to, you know, my bread and butter, the rugby codes, I've heard stories of coaches shouting at trainers for taking the water on. Get that water off. They need to tough it out in training. You know, they need to tough it out. You're like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Like, and it's not like we don't have the empirical research behind it. We absolutely know what dehydration does. No questions asked. We know what it does, right? And you're wanting these guys to perform, but you're not letting them optimally fuel and optimally hydrate to perform. So, you know, how are they supposed to do it?
So 1% dehydration is 10% performance.
It's a bit broad. Like, everyone sweats at different rates. You know, the content of the sweat is different. But put it this way, there's a significant decrement.
Yeah.
And the more dehydrated you get,
I mean, that, you know, basically the worse what that you speaks perform. To is that there's a, like, a small amount of dehydration significant impactful.
Yeah. And, you know, this sport, you've already weight cut. You know, I'm not sure of the layover effect of that in terms of chronic dehydration from that weight cut. Mm. Yeah, you might feel hydrated because acutely you've hydrated yourself back up, but what are the chronic consequences of that? I'm not sure. You know, the PI might be able to enlighten us.
Interesting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think something's going to change soon because there's a lot of, I mean, the UFC are working closely with the Cleveland Clinic.
Amazing.
Like, when I've been out in Vegas, I've been there a couple of times now, and they basically, like, you know, they borrow you for an hour and they do a bunch of tests, a bunch of MRI scans, a load of cognitive tests. There was one where I had this harness on with an iPad on my back. Have you seen this?
Yeah, maybe.
And I had to do a lot of, like, single leg stuff and, like, reaching and touching.
Yeah.
and like twisting and looking to see, it was interesting. But
coordinate your balance and stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I'd be really interested because I know a lot of sort of there was a lot of not propaganda is not the right word, but there was a lot of heat around how much the UFC reinvest their profits into the fighters, and it seemed to be a lot lower than the other professional sports in the US, which is a separate argument. But I'll be interested to see what percentage of their turnover or profits they invest into R&D, because it seems like they're going pretty hard. It seems like they want to evolve as fast as they can evolve. I mean, going back to the PI, like, that's not cheap. Creating those two PIs is costing a lot, you know, that's costing a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think they leverage that by other people using those facilities, but you would think that would be a drop in the ocean.
Minimal, isn't it? For sure. Especially, I mean, the Shanghai facility is, I mean, it's basically an MMA university, isn't it? They've got everything that you would need there to grow.
If you had a blank piece of paper, well, I'm sure that's probably what they did. Yeah. Right, here's a blank piece of paper, guys.
Yeah. Here's a space in Shanghai.
Yeah.
And then you've got the one over in Vegas, which much more caters to the athletes that are already established and offers them services that they'd need.
So the Shanghai one, as far as I know from speaking to Dean, is like, they run a team out of there. That's their team. And, you know, they actually run that how I would run a professional team. Yeah, they're killing it, right? Just everywhere.
Yeah. You've got to kind of feel like, I mean, if you're going into a fight with someone that's training at the UFC Performance Institute, like,
meanwhile you're skirting between three different places to get your sessions in.
You're dead right, things have got to move in that direction, and it's just an awareness thing, isn't it, for fighters? You need to take stuff seriously and make sure that,
you know, because we're close to the sport, you forget how young it is, and it's doing its evolution. You know, it's evolving way faster than all the other codes that are around.
Yeah.
Because they've had more time to evolve, and, you know, to some degree, fair play to the UFC, because they are investing, they are doing the R&D, and they are evolving as fast as they can. Mm. It'd be interesting to see where it goes, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Colin, what do you do with Chandler now?
What do I do with him?
Where do you go?
I think he's one of the two problem children in the division. I think it's him and Charles Oliveira are the two real problems for everybody. Obviously, you know, you could put Chandler in there with Poirier, but then I think that's a bad matchup for Poirier.
Mm.
I think you could put Poirier in there with Charles Oliveira, and I think that might be a good fight for him, but he also might get strangled if he gets clipped and hurt.
Mm.
And Oliveira's striking's come on leaps and bounds. And you know, the holes in Poirier's game from back in the WEC days are still there to an extent. I mean, he was still clipped with a couple of good shots against McGregor. Like, someone with sharp striking that's got a jiu-jitsu game to fall back on might be he's just a problem for everybody. Chandler's an issue because he's got that power wrestling with that power striking style, which can just catch any of these guys. Gaethje's, you know... Gaethje's in an awkward situation.
It's tough to be a matchmaker, isn't it?
Coming back, I mean, that's another one. That's another one you got to consider.
And I mean, I know it's a long shot, and there's a few people saying that he wouldn't necessarily deserve it. But I was chatting to Owen. So anyone that doesn't know, Owen is part of Full Reptile, and basically he runs our whole apparel side of the business, right? Single handedly, he's basically
we'll be
a machine.
Back on podcast soon as well.
And he does Full Reptile Radio. I'm sure we're going to try and get that back as soon as we can. We were chatting before, and again, it's probably not quite deserved because he's fresh in there. But it is interesting, wrestler v wrestler, right? Does he have the zig to Habib Zag? I don't know. Habib doesn't seem to think so. He wasn't particularly impressed, was he? But
no,
you know.
But then you know, that's one fight against number six ranked Dan Hooker, and I feel like Dan Hooker's a bit young in his career, and he's found himself right up at the top because he'll say yes and he'll bite down his mouthpiece and he'll fight anyone.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we've got a clear distinction in the division now, and I think what we've got is, you know, McGregor, Oliveira, Poirier, Gaethje, and Chandler are the top five. You could even maybe drop Gaethje or McGregor out of that mix now. But then if you throw Nate Diaz in, you've kind of got to need one of those guys. I wouldn't mind seeing Nate against Gaethje. I wouldn't mind seeing Poirier against Oliveira. I wouldn't mind seeing McGregor fight Ferguson, to be honest.
I know, but you keep skirting and we're talking about Chandler. Who's he going to fight?
I think
it's
honestly...
It's really difficult.
He's a problem for everybody.
Nate would be fun, whether... you know, Nate could keep that distance and just pepper him for so long that let's see where Chandler is.
I mean, he did take 14
minutes
kicks.
In.
You know,
yeah,
like there were. He does have a very long stance, and there were a couple of low kicks that Hooker did land out in the open. Like there are people that could cause him problems. But then, like the thing is, like Charles Oliveira is the kryptonite to someone like Chandler, as long as he stays out of the power punching range. Like you can power double me all day you like. I'm gonna strangle you as soon as we hit the mat. The power punching range is where Oliveira has been closed down against the fence and hurt.
Maybe that's the one.
I mean, you've got to think that Chandler against Gaethje would be a fascinating one, but I don't think that's fair to Gaethje to throw him in there after what he just went through.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind seeing Gaethje against Ferguson, two guys coming off losses.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't get my hopes up about Ferguson anymore. After we saw him trying to wrestle a float tank, I'm like, look, the dude's going to get injured, man. He's wrestling float tanks. What do you want? What do you want, Tony? We get it. You're weird. That's fine. Could you just like rein it in a couple of notches so you can make it to a fight? That'd be great.
With sunglasses on as well.
I mean, you know.
I mean, I've got my Fight Island sunglasses on, but I'm also not wrestling a float tank. Yeah. So it's not quite as dangerous. Right, go on then. Main event then. Talk to me about the main event.
Yeah, I mean, I know...
Your boy lost.
Yeah, bad, right? Bad.
Did you see it coming?
Nah.
Could you have seen that it playing out that way?
Nah, not really. And I know that clearly shows how smart you are and how in tune you are with mixed martial arts. But nah, not...
Mate, you talk for 40 minutes, you're going to be on the money about something.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
I didn't, obviously, clearly, by the way I spoke about him before, I didn't see it go like that. I thought, again, he came out trying to finish him in 60 seconds, like he said, and instantly sort of worried me. Like, wow, you better finish him now because, you know, you went all in on this, you know.
Came in too hot.
He came in really hot, didn't he? Really hot.
He didn't use anything other than aggression to close the distance down.
And I think, I don't want to, you know, obviously I don't want to talk for him. He whacked him a couple of times and Dustin sort of took it and he must have been thinking, well, not many people take that. They normally go down when I hit them that hard. And that was sort of the beginning of the end.
Dustin does take a good shot, though.
Yeah.
And it was like, if you watch the fight play through, it's like the first minute is really interesting. Because immediately as the fight happens, and the start was really awkward as well. I'm not sure whether you remember. But Herb was like, start, no, you stay in your corner, you can come out to the centre. He was more like a traffic conductor.
Yeah, I know, but like Connor's just doing what he wants. He's not even listening.
I'll
start this fight, don't worry.
No, you come to the... No, just start. And then Connor's like in his face immediately. But like it seemed Poirier was conscious about, I'm gonna take my time. I'm going to weather this early storm. If I can dig a kick into that lead leg, I will do. And I've got this takedown, which he's not expecting.
Mike Brown game plans, right? We've heard this a couple of times, haven't we? Mike Brown game plans. Man, that's how you fight Connor, innit?
It's beautiful. Because he smothered him for long enough to take away that panic first couple of minutes that makes him uncomfortable. The striking in the clinch was good from both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Connor's shoulder strikes are impressive.
They seem to do some damage, don't they?
Like, there was one, he hit Poirier on the nose and you kind of saw Poirier go,
ugh.
You know.
Yeah.
And Poirier gave a few good shots back. The striking in the clinch was good. Connor's knees to the midsection were good as well. But then, like, for the last sort of, I don't know, for like, 2 minutes on the clock to 30 seconds on the clock, Connor was pushing him back. He landed that lovely lead uppercut that he hit on Max Holloway back in the day. But then about 30 seconds left, something around there, like Poirier landed a kick and it was just a game changer for Connor. Like you just saw his leg kind of go and then he had to immediately adjust.
If you could take a picture of everyone watching that fight, when that kick landed, everyone went, ooh.
Yeah.
Everyone knew what was going on, didn't they?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's no way back. It's like going back to the neurology. Once that nerve deadened, it's not really coming back. There's just not enough time in a fight for it to come back.
Yeah, it makes it even more impressive what Cejudo did against DJ the second time around. Because that first round, he was dragging his foot behind him.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what was interesting, obviously watching the fight and re-listening to your breakdown, and then, you know, we pulled out the bit about the lower leg kicks. So Connor's very, very heavy on that foot. neuroplasticity is just a fancy way of saying we can retrain our brain. You know, there's enough fluidity in the way that our neurons work that we can retrain them and reprogram them. But it takes some work. Mm. It really does take some work. It's definitely doable. So from coaching in running sports to change the way someone runs, right? You've run the way you've run since you're a kid. So to change that is doable, definitely doable. And in some respects, you can retrain the brain to do that quite quickly. But, you know, we're talking more like year on year rather than month on month. Connor's stance is what it is. Can he adapt that quick enough to solve this problem if this problem was to come up again?
I think so. I don't think, like, I saw there was a conversation going on my Twitter because I asked for questions for the next show that I'm recording, and one of the questions was like there was a couple of guys got into a debate about the calf kick, and it was like, I don't want to see fights get stopped because of calf kicks, so I think we should take them out. And I'm like, well, first of all, they're effective, and MMA is about finding what's effective. There was a point where wrestlers just drowned people with pressure up against the fence, but MMA evolved and adapted. And what's exciting is that someone's going to figure out how to deal with the calf kick.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be someone like McGregor that figures it out. And you can't appreciate it until you've either felt it like that, experienced it like that, or you have an understanding of how dangerous that kick is. Like even at the gym, we can't have guys throwing it in shin pads because it gets through. Yeah. Like it'll still deaden your leg through a shin guard. It takes hardly anything.
You can't remove things like that from sport because it's stifling evolution. Like that's not, you know, we evolve because of the constraints that are placed around us. So if you just, we don't like that, we're going to take that out. We're never going to figure that out because it won't be a problem. We don't have to figure that out anymore.
Exactly.
You know,
it's a problem that needs to marinate in the sport a little bit until someone finds a solution. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot, because obviously it's been a narrative for the past couple of years. And I think the solution is to attack the kick. Like you've got to be a bit brutal about it, and you've got to meet it with your shin.
Yeah.
And like McGregor met it a couple of times, but he's still meeting it with the muscle that is over the nerve.
Yeah, he addressed that, didn't he? He said, I thought I was checking it, but I just wasn't checking it either aggressively enough or with enough pination around that joint to get bone on bone. Mm. But I mean, so that the stance, you know, we talked about the stance being a little bit of an issue, but we widened the stance to deal with the wrestlers, and now we're trying to have to narrow the stance to deal with the calf kicks. It's like, you can't win. But you know, we've talked about, and this massive project that we've got coming up, Lessons of War, you know, we've talked about what do you call the first position, ground zero. Zero position, right?
Zero.
And it is it is a little bit squarer. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit squarer. Mm-hmm. And the stance is slightly narrower. Yeah. And you know, I wonder, you know,
I mean, I'm doing a whole video about that stance and the reason why I feel like it's the starting point for all martial arts. Everything from that point is a transition. And Connor starts oftentimes in one of two transitional positions. He either starts in the long karate stance where he comes out throwing kicks, which he didn't do at all in the Poirier fight, but is always a value to him because it allows him to cut the octagon down without leaving himself vulnerable for any return attacks. And he didn't do that against Poirier the second time around. So like he basically used aggression and footwork instead. And in order to do that, you've got to keep planting that weight on that lead leg. And that puts him in a position where he's ready to throw his left hand. Like one of my favorite boxers, as you know, probably my favorite boxer of all time is Julio Cesar Chavez. And I always think his style would be perfect for MMA because he's heavy on the lead leg. And once you're in that range where his kind of combinations work, you stand on their front foot anyway.
Yeah.
But you don't come out of the corner in that stance because you're going to go through ranges where that's no use to you. And Connor went through ranges where that stance was no use to it, and just like bullishly applied.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this a bit, right? It's knowing why are you doing that? You don't need to be like that in that range. Yes, now you're in that range. Now you do need to be like that. Why are you doing? Don't just do it for the sake of doing it. Do it with a calculated reason behind.
Yeah, like everyone's excited about Chimaev, right? And you know, people go, oh, you know, hype train this and blah blah blah, and you know, like. There's a reason why people are excited about him. Like one of the best demonstrations of footwork I've seen in the UFC in ages was his fight against Mershaw, because I've had a few people mention it as well, hearing it on the War Room, the choke point. like you force somebody into a corner where they have to deal with the power that you're throwing at them.
Yeah.
And he did that with presence and footwork to the point where he threw one punch to knock him out.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, goes back to forced evolution. Like, this is where we're going to go. The sport's so young. People are, they're addressing these things. You know, you've got to remember that whenever something like that happens, everybody's watching it. Everyone's, you know, it's lighting up something in their brain. They're going back, they're talking to their mates about it, they're talking to the coaches about it. And that's why the evolution is so fast, because it's like, oh, quick, we've got to adapt. And then, you know, I mean, who knows where it ends, right?
I don't know. I mean, it could get to the stage where it's looking a bit supernatural, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Something else that they were talking about on the Lex Fridman, Dan Gable podcast is, you know, the first person to run a 5-minute mile.
Yeah. And then suddenly everyone
can
do it.
And now most people that are successful on the world stage, they're running 4-minute miles before they're leaving school.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you think to yourself, well, with the technology that's being applied at the PIs, with the knowledge that's now coming through from guys that either were coaches or were fighters back in the day when the sport was evolving, and they've evolved with it.
Yeah. And minds in the sport, as humans struggle to conceptualize time, because our lifetime is 80 years or whatever. Okay, what does MMA look like in 100 years' time? You can't even conceive what that's going to look like.
I'm trying.
It'd be like infinite fights. Like, no one can beat anyone, because there's a count to every count, and everyone already knows what it is.
Yeah, but there's too many margins for error in MMA for it really not to be a conclusion.
There's massive amount of variables in there. Massive amount. Physical variables.
I love it.
Emotional variables. You know,
that's why these lessons are always taking ages, because I'm trying to bulletproof it. So
you know, I don't want to blow too much smoke, but you know, I think it's a really important project that we're doing, and I think people are going to love it. And not, you know, I personally can't wait to watch it. You know, one through to 1,000 of the episodes. I think it'd be a bit of a legacy piece for you. Yeah, I'm excited. I really am.
It's one of the reasons why I've decided, I've got plectrums all over the house now. It's one of the reasons why I've decided to learn the guitar, is I want to be a beginner at something again and go through the process of learning and be frustrated and have to go over things. So, you know, when I'm communicating these lessons of war videos, that they make sense.
Mm. I like this humble Connor.
Yeah.
I quite like him.
But I mean, then it poses the question, how much of his success was that psychological game of breaking people before the fight start? I mean, the question for me going into this one, as we discussed, was where's Poirier's mind at? Because that's the one thing you can't tell when you look at a fighter.
Yeah.
Like, you can see performances, you can see successes and adaptations in their game, but you don't know whether someone can deal with Conor McGregor until they're back up against Conor McGregor.
But I
thought he looked great.
Poirier sort of said, I think he might have shouted to DC, you know, he doesn't love this. He's not doing that for that. He's just got to a point where he's just really good at it. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to maximize, you know, he's invested. It's like a business investment, right? He's invested all of this time and all of this energy in getting his product to, you know, this level, Apple level, right? And now, you know, I sort of don't love it, but I need to cash this in now. I've been here a long time. It's time for me to get paid. With that, there's always, you know, that's finite, because unless you genuinely truly love it, you just can't get through the camps, can you? You just can't get through all the baggage that goes with it.
He's on a sprint finish, though, isn't he? I mean, how many fights has he got?
We can pick and choose pretty much now. What do you reckon? Three, maybe?
I don't know.
Three big ones?
I could see five out of him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's only 32, but he's had 34 fights.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's only 32.
Yeah. When did he make his debut? Like 1974, it was a long time ago. 2009.
God, he's hard not to like Poirier, isn't he? I'll be a mate. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, everyone doesn't like someone. You know, there's always some haters out there, but he's hard not to like. Like, he's the first person he pointed out was his wife. You know, they just got this. We've been through all this shit together, and it's you know, you helped me get here and stuff. It's beautiful. He's got this foundation helping out kids, and you know, what's the first thing?
He's $500,000 McGregor donated to.
Yeah, fair play. That's like me donating £5 though. It's about the same relatively.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I wish him, the first thing he wanted to do was just go home. I'm gonna go home. I'm gonna be a dad. I'm gonna be back in my hometown. You know,
I think there's a benefit in not putting your heart and soul in things. You know, and I think, you know, that's something that we learn as we go through this. Like, you can love the sport and be too in love with the sport, and then, you know,
are you talking to yourself right now?
A little bit, yeah. I'm having a little bit of a conversation with myself here. You know, and then you can kind of pull back and you can kind of think, nah, like, I need to focus on myself and put my best version of myself forward for the sport. Like, if he's taking the emotion out of it now, he's not in a situation where he's vulnerable to trash talk, because he can detach. This is 10% of who I am.
This is
what's most important to me.
Yeah.
Like, to, you know, that it puts him in a position of strength, and it also puts him in a position of making good decisions. Because I think at this point in his career, and in the division that he's in, you only get to the champion to the championship position if you make good decisions as well.
Yeah, and he's earned that right to be in a position. I like what you're saying. It is a position of strength, because you're not going to make rash emotional decisions. You're going to make calculated, cold decisions, aren't you? And generally, that's where you make the best decisions. You know, when whatever happens, you sort of blow up and you get emotional about it. And then if you can just wait that 24 hours and then settle and then, you know, make your retort or what have you, generally comes out pretty good.
I
loved it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole thing. I didn't necessarily enjoy seeing my picks get decimated by the result, but you know, the only way to not get a pick wrong is to not make a pick, right?
That's exactly right. You did it pretty terribly, but you know, there's always room for improvement, and that was the first episode.
Like, there we go.
You can't knock it out of the park immediately.
Imagine if I do go backwards. I was going to say the only way is up, but what happens if it comes out as none next time? Anyway, yeah, enjoyed it.
Good stuff.
And I hope everyone enjoyed me not tapping the mic this episode as well. So we're improving.
Nice.
We're improving.
Cool.
Yeah, man. See you next time.
Thanks, everybody. See you next time.